Well, it's my great privilege to introduce to you Steve Nicholson, who has, over the last 10 years particularly, been of just great help to the church here on a number of occasions. I think he's actually been through on 5 occasions we worked out, and always his timing is superb. It's always come at a kind of critical moment in the life of the church here, and has always been a great blessing. Steve leads a thriving church in Chicago. Out of that church, has planted many churches and is on the board of the Vineyard in the US of A, and is responsible for church planting, and just told me yesterday that they've planted 75 churches in USA last year. So he has some great experience and great wisdom on how to plant and also to build churches, leads churches, some 700-800 himself in Chicago. So let's welcome Steve as he comes and shares with us this morning.
I'm going to jump right in because I don't want to lose any minutes of what Terry's going to say to us later this morning. What I'm doing first is just what I hope is some bits of practical wisdom on churches between the size of 200 and 500. I want to begin by saying I had a chance to read over the paper from Tim Keller that I believe Steve has stuck in all of your little folders there. That is worth the price of this conference, that little paper. When I looked at it, I thought, I cannot wait to come home, copy this for all my staff, and talk over it, because I think it's brilliant. So do take advantage of that. You know, on the one hand, it seems kind of very obvious. The difference between a church of 200 and a church of 400 is 200 more people. But everything is different at that point, because essentially of the limits of human capacity. The deal is this. When you're in a church of 200, you can kind of know everybody, or at least kind of know who belongs and who doesn't. And I remember when our church first started going past this point, it was kind of a panic that set in, because all of a sudden, people who'd been in the church for many years found themselves being greeted and welcomed as newcomers by people who'd come more recently. And it was a definite sign that we didn't know everybody anymore. You just can't. One person can only really keep acquainted with a certain number of people. And that all starts kind of changing at 200. And with that means that how you work together, how you lead, how you move forward, still kind of in unity and together, all has to change, because it can't all be purely on the basis of an immediate one-to-one network of relationships, because there's just no room. And so there are a whole bunch of challenges that take place at that size. Now, I think in America we always say, for the average church member, probably about the ideal size of church, if it's not 50, it's probably about 300 or 400 in terms of comfort for an average person. There's some great advantages to 50. You know everybody, it's your immediate circle of friends, and you got a pastor who's very available. And 50 people can actually keep you busy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. The other, of course, you know, but 400 is a very nice size, because there is a little bit more complexity that you have to deal with, but you can do a little bit more. You have more resources, you can have more ministries, but it's not so big that the complexity level really goes way up, and you have to deal with all the challenges that that means. And one of the things that Tim Keller points out in this paper you've got is that as churches grow, the level of complexity increases exponentially. So one of the things he'll point out is ideally a church of 400 will have like twice the number of not just twice the number of ministries of a church of 200, but four times the number of ministries of the church of 200, which means not double the level of complexity, four times the level of complexity, and so on. Okay, in terms of organization and leadership. So, with that kind of general background in mind, I wanted to talk about some of the key challenges of growing from 200 to 500. And as is almost always the case, the initial challenge has to do with how you lead. And which has a lot to do with your mindset. Fundamentally, the way you lead and the nature of your job as a leader in a church of 400 is going to be completely different than the way it is in a church of 150, with just some little corners of similarity, but mostly very different. Because at the smaller level, you can lead most people directly to some degree. And you might have a whole network of small groups, but you still know a lot of the people in the small group. And you're still kind of relating to them, and they are bonding to you as the leader still. The small group leader is a helper, an assistant in essence. But at a certain point, that really changes quite a lot. One of the things you have to realize is that when people come into a church, they have this thing that you would call like bonding. They need to kind of bond to a leader as, this is my leader. This is the person who is my pastor. It's a very kind of, almost like a family kind of a thing, you know, which is why they so often fall into transference of family issues, you know, where their problems with their father come out on you. That happens over here, right? They do that to you too? Yeah, sure they do. Because it is a kind of a similar thing. So the thing is, at about 200, their ability of more people to kind of gather around you and bond to you, there's just no more room. A very American analogy kind of comes to mind. You know, there's just too many piglets for all the kids, you know. I had to throw something in there. Okay, so if you're going to go past 200, one of the key ingredients of getting past 200 is you have to get another person who is a significant pastoral leader that people can bond to and relate to. So when you come into a church of 400, what you'll find is people, you'll say, who's the leader of the church? And they'll say, so-and-so is the leader of the church. But then if you ask them, who's your pastor? Some of them will say that same person. But others of them will say, no, it's this other person who's my pastor. You know, if there's a funeral or a wedding, I'm going to ask them. Okay? And they start relating as their pastor primarily this other person. It's like every circle has to have a focal point. And the deal of going from 200 to 400 is you're moving from a one-circle church to a two-circle church. You're not going to get a second circle without a second focal point, which means another significant pastoral leader has to come into play. And then if you're going to go from there to the next level, probably a second and a third and a fourth. And it's a lot about people's perceptions. They have to perceive this person as being capable of filling that role for them, which means that visibility and status are important. So if you add, as your second pastor say, a children's pastor that's in the crutch, okay, that's going to make that work really well, but it's not going to create a second circle of relationship because most of the people never see them. You follow what I'm saying? You've got to add somebody who they will see as a focal point, somebody who preaches part of the time, somebody who gives them notices part of the time, second circle of relationship. And then as the leader, you have to be able to lead through those people. more and more through the staff, through significant lay people. You have to lead through them, which means increasingly you don't lead directly and may not even know everything directly. You may not know everything that's happening. As we were going through this point, one of the things that happened was the Lord basically said, you know, there's a bottleneck in this church and it's you. And the problem is, everything had to come through me. Everything. All the information, all the ministry, everything that happened had to be approved by me. Well, you know what? I ran out of time to approve. So everything is backing up. And God finally said, well, look, I want to do more ministry for this church than what you can start. I love starting ministries. But it was kind of like, you know, I was the one that was starting everything. He says, I want to do more ministry through the church than what you can start. In fact, he says, I want to do more ministry in the church than what you have time to approve of. And in fact, he says, I want to do more ministry through this church than you even have time to hear about. You'll have to wait till heaven to hear it. Which means what? You have to let go of a certain level of control. How do you do that? Well, you have to get a lot better at picking leaders, knowing which ones understand your vision and values, and which are loyal, and which have good character, and then trust them. And you have to trust the Holy Spirit in the church, that maybe He knows what's going on better than you. And we all say, yeah, 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 but just wait till this rubber meets the road and He wants to start something that you don't start yourself and can't get all the information all the time about, and then see. Which is why a lot of churches don't go past this point, because fundamentally, the leader, the person who's at the front end of this thing, just isn't comfortable with that kind of leadership. They really like having their hands dirty in the front line with every individual person and knowing what's going on, and feel very uncomfortable with leading a lot of people that they don't actually know what's happening. And so what happens for me, you know, my church now is about close to 800 people coming on a Sunday. Most of the people there, I don't know where they're at with God, let alone the rest of their life. I have 150 to 200 leaders that are working with those people. I have to trust those leaders and work through them and count on them to do it. And you can't, there's not enough of me even to check up on all my leaders. How am I going to check up on 150 leaders? I can't check up on 150 leaders. I can't even begin to meet with them all. Alright? Which means, you know, you got another level there. So you have to learn to lead through other people and develop these different circles of identification and bonding. One of the tricky things, though, is that you do, particularly up to like 500 or so, you have to keep a certain balance. So there's this balance between delegation and involvement. If you go too far the other way, to where you only ever see leaders, you can become too distant from sort of the grassroots of the church and not have enough of an idea of what's happening there to even preach to them effectively. You know, so... You know, in business, I think there's, at one point there was a book that came out, you know, Management by Walking Around or something like that. And there's a certain sense at which you want to kind of hang on to some of that. Just being around, dropping in on different parts from time to time to just see what's happening there, you know. Being available to, for just an average person to come and talk to you. And the way I do it is I have a little time block that's just completely open for anybody in the church to come and meet with me. And it's just set aside. And it's just on a first-come, first-served basis. Whoever asks for it first gets it. But that way, when somebody in the church asks for a meeting, the answer is never no. It's just a question of when. You know, and sometimes that means, you know, well, it's going to be 2 months before you can get a meeting with Steve, or you can meet with one of these other pastors next week. You know? And sometimes they wait, you know, but sometimes it's not, there isn't a wait. It just depends on how it's worked out. But that way, at least, I end up with getting to talk to some people, and it's actually good for me because I found that there's something very vital for me as a person that from time to time I meet with one of our seekers that are in the church. We always have, you know, we always have a certain number of what you might call seekers. People are attending the church, but they have not yet made a commitment to Jesus. They're asking questions. I need some of that involvement, or who are brand new Christians. You know, and it kind of gives me life. It's to help me be sane. You know, if you only ever relate to pastors and leaders and only ever Christians, you're going to become a weird person indeed. You know, you need something to kind of balance it out. Along with that, of course, the level of impact that you're looking for from leaders and staff and the level of competence has to go up. And I think Tim says more about this in his paper than I'm going to say today, but just think about it this way. When you've got a group of 80 people and they're gathered together, there's a real sense of it's a family together. And they're there, you know, and holding together because of relationship. And there's a lot of horizontal things that are happening to make that time meaningful. But when you have 500 people, they don't have that. They don't know all those other people. And if there's like 10 minutes of somebody rattling on about something nobody cares about, and that doesn't relate to them, you know, there's a couple hundred people feeling like they're wasting my time. So the whole thing of how you handle the pacing of your meetings, the notices, all those things, all changes. You have to talk a lot differently. Everything has to be scripted a lot more further in advance. You'll often find that you just have to plan further out. Because if you have a lot of leaders and they're all taking initiative, you've picked high quality people and they're being led by the Holy Spirit and they're wanting to start this and that and the other thing. How do you keep them from like showing up in the same room at the same time wanting to do different meetings? Well, you gotta have some kind of sign-up system or something. So, you know, there's a certain level of, I mean, there are different words you can use depending on how pejorative you want to be. Administration, bureaucracy, whatever, that you have to add just to keep everybody from walking all over each other. And which means what? You've got to plan further out. So the reality for my church is we generally have a policy. Anybody can start a new ministry as long as they don't need any money or staff time. And we tell them this in the sort of intake class, the new members class. If you have an idea for a new ministry and you want to start it, the answer is yes. Don't come and ask me for approval. I left my approval stamp. Okay? So here it is. Just, as long as it's legal, no bank robbing for Jesus, but, you know, and as long as you don't need any money and staff time. Why? Because money and staff time are limited commodities. We have a process of prioritizing those things. But if you can do it on your own, the answer is yes. But if they want to like use a room in the building, one of the things they learn is if you want to get a room in this building, you can't like come in on Tuesday and think, I want a room on Wednesday. This is not going to happen. They're going to all be booked. You have to plan ahead. You have to work further ahead. And that's just one of the things that happens all the way across as you start moving from a small church of under 200 to a church over 200. Everything has to be planned ahead. Level of competence has to be higher. Expectation for music is higher, and so forth. All right. Two, facilities. If you haven't, by the time you have 200 people, dealt with some kind of significant move towards owning your own facilities, you probably will soon. And it's one of the biggest hurdles and the biggest obstacles that you face in moving from 200 to 500 people. And it is very important and difficult. I recently saw a survey in the United States where they surveyed non-church people and kind of asked them a series of questions where they're asking them, how would you feel about visiting a church that met in different places? And 70% of the people said they had a negative feeling about visiting a church that met in a school. Now, my church, I'm now in my 30th year at the church that I'm at. And we did not hear this talk soon enough. The consequence of it was that we did not start looking for our own facility until about 10 years ago. Then we went through a long 10-year process, which I'll tell you about later. But we finally got in our building just this last April. So I would not recommend that you follow our model in that respect, timing-wise. But the most amazing thing happened. Now, we had been in a school for a high school, the biggest meeting room in town, for about 15 years. And we had done all kinds of things to be visible in the community. We'd been in the newspaper tons of times, lots of visibility. But when we got in this building, hundreds of people began showing up that hadn't showed up before. I mean, we spent all summer just scrambling to keep up with all this surge of people. And as we talk to these people, this is what they say. We've been watching you guys for years. And now that you're in this building, we decided to check you out. And I'm thinking, what, you couldn't go to the high school? But they just wouldn't. They just wouldn't. And now they're there. And there's a whole, I think a lot of us are pioneering people. You know, to me, you know, high school building, it's a womb, you know, to me. It doesn't seem different to me. But all I can tell you is, out there, it's a difference. So, my feeling is, when you get to 200 people, you should start looking and praying. And praying. Maybe fasting. You could try groveling. Start. Okay, saving money. Because what you want to do, you really need to kind of get something of your own that becomes an identifiable location. And there's just something about the air of legitimacy that starts to come. And also, here's the thing. You are wanting to multiply ministries. Okay, remember, quadruple from 200 to 400. Where are you going to do it? And if you don't kind of have a place that has rooms in it that is really under your control 24 hours a day, you're going to be bumping up every time you try to do something. Where are we going to do it? Where are we going to do it? Where are we going to do it? So you really need to start. And here's what we didn't do. When you're buying your house to live in, when you're a young family, generally you don't buy the house you're going to have when your family is full and they're teenagers. Right? You buy what's called a starter house. And that kind of leverages you into what you're eventually going to get later. And see, that's the step that we didn't do, and it caused us a lot of trouble. So what I'd suggest is sometime between 200 and 400 people, you should be getting a starter house. Someplace. You know, a warehouse, a redundant church building, something. Preferably something that you can get an auditorium with about 300 seating in it. Okay? With enough meeting rooms so you can have some different kind of ministry activities going on at the same time and enough room for the children. And in America, I'd add parking. I realize parking's irrelevant here. Nobody has parking ever anyway, so you know, you can grow big churches here with no parking, it seems. So anyway, you need to start looking for that kind of place. If it can be more visible, that's fine. If it's less visible, that's all right. You know, more visible, of course, is obviously better, but it doesn't need to be. And just depending on where you are, I understand you're from all over the country, so you may not all have the same exact circumstances, may determine what that looks like. But I think it's a very important step, is getting a place that can be a ministry center for you at some point. And I know even just when you have a place, making it functional in a significant way can do an awful lot to move things forward. And I remember one visit here at King's Church. I don't know how many of you saw this church before they did all the stuff to it. A few of you. I mean, the transformation is dramatic. It's hard to explain what was here before because it's almost disappeared. But basically, they had a building here, but it wasn't set up in a functional fashion at all. You had one big auditorium that was, you know, the typical long and narrow thing, and the acoustics were atrocious, and the what they had in terms of meeting rooms and so forth were very inadequate. I think the previous century, you know, they only thought of the adult service and the whole thing of multiplying ministries and having, you know, all kinds of things for children and this and that and the other thing. It wasn't kind of part of the picture. They didn't build buildings that way. And I just remember when they did this transformation, what happened here at King's Church was just phenomenal. It just, boom, immediate change because of the building. So it just became more functional. And that leads immediately to, of course, the third key challenge in growing, and that is money. So we're going to talk a little bit about money. You know, the reality is your biggest resources in a church are pretty much in this order: trust, people, money. Okay? And it takes all of them to really do the job. And of course, it's in that order because without trust, you're not going to get the other two. Without people, you're not going to get any money, because that's where the money comes from. You know, so it's kind of in that order: trust, people, money. Now, about money, a few thoughts. First of all, generally, money follows vision, not need. Which means you have to have a strong vision. We are going to make a difference. We are going to do something that changes things in our community, in our town. That, you know, and even raising money for a building, you can't say that it's about, well, we need a building, we're going to get a building. You have to tie that to a vision to change people's lives. You know, you have to very carefully articulate, you know, a building is a tool to get to people and to make a difference in people. And you start talking about all the ministries that can take place there. You create a sense of vision that produces people's ability to give financially. One of the things we did when we first started working on this is we gave everybody a card, and it was like their dream card, and they were all supposed to write down their ideas of how we can use this building to make a difference in people's lives when we get it. And then as we were kind of building up to this thing, every Sunday I'd read about 10 cards. Just stand up. Different people's ideas. Well, when we get a building, we could do this. We could use the building for this. We could use the building for this. And it just created this sense of possibility. And so it's not just about we need a building. It became, no, this building is a way for us to make a big difference in our town, in a lot of people's lives. That's what produces money. So you need a vision. And you have to be very clear and articulate about the vision. Second thing, it's generally good in church life, and if you haven't started working with this before you're at 200, you really need to start working at it. And that is, you have to consciously think about what does it take to have this enterprise that you're doing before, you know, fully funded. Now, I understand that from the pastor's point of view, it's never fully funded. We'd always like more people and more money. You know, we are in some ways the most discontent people on the earth. If 1,000 people could be saved on Sunday, and we're thinking, oh, but it could have been 2,000. You know, it's never enough, you know, because we have this thing inside, of course, that we're focused on the harvest, you know, the people that aren't yet there. And so it's never enough. So there's always that reality that we always wish we had more money. But I think there's what's reasonable. And just a couple of things that we use that maybe would be helpful. We like to use benchmarks. So, for example, a pretty common benchmark in the U.S. is, on the average, a church should be getting $20 per head per Sunday, which would be about 10 pounds given the current exchange rate, okay? 10 pounds per person per Sunday, including the heads, include all the children. Okay, so if you have 200 people on a Sunday, including children, you should be looking at 2,000 pounds a week. If it's significantly less than that, that is a sign that some there's a disconnect somewhere that is being that the lack of the money is a symptom of, and I'll come back to what those might be. If it's a lot more than that, great. Hallelujah. Okay, I think the last time we checked at our church, it was about 28, something like that. So what does it mean if it's lower than that? Now, obviously, if you're in a very blighted neighborhood, you know, most of your people are unemployed, that's not going to apply. That's an average sort of mixed, you know, middle-class kind of peg point. But generally, if it's lower than that, there's what are the things that could mean that there's a problem? One, the vision isn't clear. People don't actually know where this church is going. It could mean that there isn't enough information. People don't actually know that the church needs money and that it costs money. And more people need information before they're willing to commit financially. They're just not going to do it automatically. There's too much skepticism about leadership in general and churches alone. They need information. And in a sense, it's not bad to give them the information because that's just a way of respecting people. Give them the information. Tell them the truth. The truth is good. You know. So give them, they need to get a certain amount of information from time to time. So, you know, twice a year at our church, they get a financial statement. It says, this is what's happened. This is what's going on. This is where the money's going. This is what it's costing us to keep the lights on. You know, this is how much you've given so far this year. Basic information. They need information. They need to know that there's accountability. Who's doing this thing? It's important for them to know. You're not setting your own salary. You know, this is not something, you know, where you get paid and your kids get paid and your wife gets paid and take the helicopter to see your house, and so on and so forth. You know, they need to know there's some kind of accountability to this thing. That, you know, of course, you know, you probably have somebody in Brussels that makes sure that you have accountability here anyway, but... But if people have a question in their minds about the accountability of this thing or the appropriateness of how money is being spent, guess what? And there you go. Or sometimes, if you're below the benchmark, it's just a simple fact you aren't asking. You just aren't asking for the money. You need to ask for it. You need to ask people for the money. Why? Because they need you to. If you are not asking your people to give, then you are not asking your people to be disciples. You should not be apologetic about it. You know, the Bible has more to say about money than just about anything else. You know, you should, you know, you don't have to be manipulative about it. just a simple, look, this is what we need to do. This is what the Bible calls us to do. Let's do it. I trust you. I know you guys can do it. Let's do it together. Let's do it. That's fine. That'll do it, but you have to ask. And one of my understandings is, as the lead pastor in my church, I understand. I have to do that. Nobody else can do that for me. The guy who carries the vision is the one who has to ask for the money. The other people, they worry about spending the money. I have nothing to do with spending the money. Okay? Other people do that. They try to be accountable. I don't touch the spending. But I have to get it. I have to ask for it. I have to bring it in. So you've got to do that. Now, one other thing, and this is something I got from John Wimber. What you have to understand is people have different pockets out of which they give. This, for me, this was revolutionary. There's a pocket that's called general giving. When the bucket comes by, this is what they'll put in. General giving and tithing. Tithes and offering. That's one pocket people will give to. But there's only so much in that pocket. There's only a certain amount of money that you will ever see out of that pocket. They have another pocket that's called ministry to the poor. If you do a project that's ministry to the poor and you ask for money, guess what? That pocket opens up and money comes. But that money will never go in the other one. And there's another pocket called missions. If you're doing something to take the gospel to another country, there's other money that's available that will be released when you do that. It will not be released until you do that ministry. All right? And there's another pocket called building. Okay? People will give you money. You will not believe what people will do on a building. I mean, I've seen stock in the offering, jewelry in the offering. I've seen people empty out their retirement accounts. I've seen people take out loans from banks and kind of tap out their equity on their houses. I've seen people take the money they saved for their kids' future education and put it all in. They will do that. But not in the tithes and offering pocket. But for that building, they'll do it. Once. Maybe twice if there's a long enough gap. All right, but you have to understand there's different pockets that you can call on. So if you're just looking at the tithe thing and you're saying, well, we don't have enough money to do this, that is not true. That is not true. Okay, there is other money available to you if you do the right stuff. And one of the things you've got to always remember, and this is true not just of money, but just of God's blessing in general. In the end, in the church, it's fundamentally not about doing everything right. In fact, often the bigger churches get, the more chaotic things become, even in the most organized situations, naturally. And you can do a lot of things wrong and still be fine. The important thing, the business in the church is to do the right things. Not doing everything right, but doing the right things. Make sure you do the right things. And don't have a heart attack if not everything goes right. You know, these little devices, they have tons of problems. They'll go wrong some Sunday or other. Usually your peak Sunday. You know, something will go wrong. Okay. That's fine. Don't worry about it. Just make sure you keep doing the right things, you know? You do the missions, you do the ministry of the poor, you know, you're praying, you're taking the gospel out there, you're doing it. So you do the right things, money and the blessing and other things will tend to come. Right? Okay. We gotta press on. Communication becomes a huge issue. Number four, the big obstacle as you're growing is communication. Communication is pretty simple at a smaller church level. You can make an announcement and they all hear it, so they're almost always there. Or you can even just start a phone tree and it goes around. You know, a lot of communication in a small church happens informally. Why? Because they all know each other. So, you know, if Betty over here, for some reason, was in the loo when the announcement was made, the notice was made, you know, her friend's going to tell her, well, you know, the prayer meeting got changed. It's now here and not there. But you know what? When your church is 400, Betty isn't going to get told. Or likely not to get told. And she's going to turn up at the wrong time. And she's not going to be happy. Okay, because she drove 30 minutes to get there. All right? Communication just starts really becoming difficult as you get bigger. And informal communication or even just single communication will not work. Everything you want to communicate must be multiplied. To say something once and think people got it is completely foolish. You have to say it like five times, five different ways. You've got to say it. It's got to be on the overhead. It's got to be on a poster out in the hallway. They've got to get an email during the week. And you've got to come back again and remind them yet one more time and before they'll get it. You have to do multiple communication of everything. And you have to have multiple ways of making people aware of what's happening. So one of the key things for us as we've gotten into our building is you got the banners, you got the video notices, you got the verbal notices. We have posters in the bathrooms. So when you're standing there in the bathroom, it's right there in front of your face. You know, right by the towels, there's another one. You know, you start creating multiple means of communication and information to people. They have to hear it a bunch of different ways. Which means, of course, you have a vast increase in the degree of communication that's written. Now, if you don't do this, what you're going to find is that you have unbearable pressure on your notice time. Anybody here ever experienced the weekly battle over the notices? Yeah. The rest of you is coming. It's sort of like, and I'll tell you something, nobody wants to come to church and listen to 25 minutes of notices. Least of all you. Right? And you don't want your church to become something you hate. Or even worse, something your wife hates. And too long a notices will do it. So, you have to multiply other means of communication and you have to change. So for us the rule is, no verbal notice for anything that doesn't affect at least half the people. Or if it's a brand new ministry that's never happened before, we'll do it once. Just to kind of let everybody know this new thing is starting, even if it doesn't apply to half the people. But generally, we fight. Now, we have to fight this all the time because everybody keeps wanting to crowd in on that, you know, because they would like to imagine that what they do applies to more than half the people. You know, and I don't resent that because I love having a church full of people who are just desperate to do ministry and who want their thing to go. I love that. Okay. So, but you've got to kind of work with that because as you get bigger, a lot more people are annoyed. Of course, if you have a lot of notices that are verbal in the main worship meeting. And, you can help a little bit if you inject humor into it once in a while. But no amount of humor will rescue 25 minutes of notices. Now there's one other thing, and that is the problem of dilution. Which is that As you start getting more and more people, you got more and more ministries, you got more and more small groups, you got more and more leaders, you start relying on the leaders, of course, to communicate things further down line. But what almost always happens is, what goes in is not what comes out. There's always evaporation rates. Sort of. There's information that somehow evaporates between when you told them and when they told their group. You know, which is what I mean by dilution. Communication dilutes downline, which is one of the reasons why you have to multiply it. You have to do it so many ways and come at it as many ways as possible. But there are some things that is particularly troublesome and will cause you a great deal of trouble if that information is diluted, like the communication of your vision and values. Because, okay, now you got people coming in. And as you get bigger, the number that are coming in, even if it's the same percentage, is a bigger and bigger number. You got 50 people and 10 new people come in. That's a big percentage. That's wonderful. That's a big growth. But you can kind of, it's pretty easy to make sure those 10 people figure out what this church is really all about and where we're going and what our values are. But what happens when you have 350 people walk in the door? Now, how do you get those people up to speed? And what often happens is the vision part, the communication of vision and values, gets spread out, of course, along with this whole dynamic of spreading out leaders, but then the vision gets diluted. So there's a few things that you can't give away. And you can't give away the communication of the vision. Nobody can do that for you. You can't delegate that to anybody. So primarily, you know, I'm the visionary one in my church. All the new people coming into our church have the opportunity. We've created a situation where they have the opportunity, to become a regular part of our church, they have to take this opportunity to hear the vision and the values. This is how we do church, directly from me. Right? No middlemen. And the way we do that is we have a membership. To be a leader, they have to be a member. To become a member, they've got to go through this class. So that they hear from me directly what we're doing, okay? So, that you can't give away. Most everything else you can give away, but you can't give away that part. Otherwise, you'll end up with whole sections of your church that start wandering off in a different direction, where you don't really want to go. Alright. Number five, organization and standards. As you grow through this kind of dynamic, what obviously has to happen is that the whole question of who can become a leader becomes even more important. And it has to become more explicit, more written down, because what's going to happen is you aren't picking all of them yourself. Right? So when I have a leaders meeting, I almost always am meeting leaders who are new leaders in our church that I'm meeting for the first time, at least since the members class. And so what we're looking for, what we require for leaders, has to be laid out in an explicit way for everybody, because it's not all funneling through me on a day-to-day basis. I still choose the staff or main ministry coordinators, where somebody who's overseeing several different ministries, I can do that, but I can't choose all the leaders. So you have to clarify sort of your standards for your leaders. And a couple of thoughts about standards. One, you've got to clarify your standards for character. What kind of character do leaders have to have? And what happens if they mess up? If they show that their character has a problem? What happens if they have a moral failure? It has to be laid out explicitly. If you commit adultery, we will remove you from leadership. And if you don't say it explicitly on the front end, if you accept a leadership position, you are accepting there's this level of accountability for your character. you're going to have a messier time dealing with it when something happens. And of course, the bigger you get, the more likely, or sooner or later, somebody's going to have a moral failure. And they'll fight back. You never told me. I never agreed to this. How can you do this? So what you have to do is you get them to agree up front. We actually have a paper that is leadership commitments, leadership character commitments, and it says, here are the issues for character if you're going to be a leader in that church, and here are the consequences if you mess up on these criteria, and you have to sign it and say you read it and agree with it and give it back to us. Okay, if you're going to be a leader in our church. We also have, you also have to have standards about commitment. You don't want to have leaders who aren't committed to what you're doing. What are the measures of commitment? Well, showing up. It's not a bad place to start. All right? Leaders are committed to showing up on a regular basis. Modern people sometimes have to be more defined. It's amazing how many people say, oh, yes, this is my church. How often do you come? Oh, about once every 8 weeks. You know? But you have to define what commitment is. Another one is finances. You know? We tell people, look, if you're going to be a leader in our church, you have to give in a way that shows commitment. You can't be a leader if you're not committed that way. And for us, we're looking for something like a tithe. And we tell them, before you get released as a leader, we're going to check. And we will check once every year thereafter. And every little once in a while, somebody comes up, they say, oh, I want to make this person a leader. Oh, let's check. Zip. Few saved. Go back. Have a talk. Find out what's happening. Because there's a problem. Commitment-wise. And over the years, I found if they are not giving generously to the church, they will let you down. Eventually. No matter what they say. No matter what their excuse is. But fundamentally, they're not committed, and they will let you and your people down when the crunch comes. So they got to be committed financially. And we don't, like, ask them to bring in their tax form, you know, and whatnot, you know. But we know they're astute. Okay, $200, not bad. They're working a downtown loft one. $200, no way. Okay, you know, we know what their life situation is, and you don't need the exact numbers, but we're not looking for the exact numbers. We're just looking for a sign of commitment. And we check, and we tell them we're going to check. We police this one. And I'm not a very happy policeman. I don't think my job is to be a policeman in the church. You know, that's not what, but when it comes to leaders and commitment, I'll police. And part of what that means is, we, every year, we get a printout. Here's the list of leaders. Here's what they get. And we go down through the list, circle in red the ones that we got problems, and then we go to them and we have a discussion. What's happening? And we talk about it. And there's always a couple, pretty much every year. And nobody objects because we've told them up front, we will do this. So they know it's coming. And we don't, like, just throw them out. We talk about it. We find out what happened. Are you having, like, some crises, you know? Are you unhappy about something? Are you trying to tell us something? You know, what is this? We talk about it. It's relational, but it has to be addressed. So you have to kind of add more clear standards and communication of those standards to how, in particular, leadership takes place. Otherwise, as you're multiplying it, you're going to run into problems with the multiplication, and it's going to make you want to pull back, see, and back off of the multiplication of leadership, which is going to shrink the church. And so you've got to kind of make the things match. All right, six, assimilation. Assimilation becomes a whole lot more difficult issue. By assimilation, I mean the process of taking a person who visits your church and turning them from a guest into a member. In a small church, when somebody new comes, everybody knows they're new. And they tend to like gather around them. They invite them over to dinner. They go to dinner. They talk to them. They tell them, you know, their stories. They tell them about the church. The assimilation happens almost organically. By the time your church is 300, they don't do that anymore because they don't know who's new. You know, they don't actually know who's new in the church. In fact, when we moved into our new building, all kinds of people in our church met people that had been in the church for 20 years that they never knew were there because it jumbled up their seating location. It was the funniest thing. You should have seen the look on their faces because we've been meeting in this high school and it had a certain kind of layout, right? So when we moved in the new building, the new layout did not in any way correspond to the old layout. You know, it was a different number of sections, different number of aisles, different lengths, all different. And you could see as they came in there, there was this look on their face like, where's my spot? And then the dawning realization, my spot does not exist anymore. You know, and so they all find themselves sitting next to different people that they'd never seen before. And they were a lot of more meeting people who'd been in the church for ages, but they'd never met them because they didn't sit in adjacent spots. And that's kind of what happens as your church gets bigger, you know. It's sort of like if this group of people sits on this side of the room, this group of people sits on that side of the room, they never meet each other. So they don't know if they're new or not. So there's no kind of natural process of incorporating people. So you have to make a process that is more formalized, that lets a new person coming in, you want to become a part of this church, here's how you do it. 1, 2, 3. In fact, I saw you got a nice poster right over there, isn't it? I think it's over there. It's on the wall over there that answers this question. Am I right about this, Paul? You don't know. Am I right about the poster? Is it that poster? Huh? That's the church plan. I saw one here somewhere. Where did I see it? As I was coming in this morning, I noticed it. They've got something on the wall as you come in that says, here's how you get involved in this church. And it's got steps lined out on it. Okay, so if you don't have that... He doesn't even know what happens. And of course, that is my point. That's the point exactly. The point, it's there. That's the only thing that's important. But yeah, it has to happen. Because why? Because otherwise people won't know how to be a part of your church. If you've studied the MCD material, Natural Church Development, how many of you studied that? Really not? You don't know about this? There's a guy named Christian Schwartz he's a German guy, who wrote this book called Natural Church Development. It's about like 8 qualities of a healthy church. And we found it enormously helpful. And one of his qualities is, he has a weird name for it. He calls it, something structures. Functional structures. He calls it functional structures. But it's about basically the communication to people of how to be a part of things and how to understand, you know, the vision and so on and so forth. And that is very necessary as your church gets bigger. If people are going to be a part, you have to give them a lot more information, a lot more systems. One of the things, for example, that we do, we invite pretty much every month, except in the summer months, all the recent newcomers to a lunch with the pastors. And we just sit down with them. We have lunch together. We meet them. We hear their stories. They get to ask us questions. They hear our stories. There's a face-to-face contact. It gives them the opportunity to interface. And we found that a very high percentage of the people, if you can get them to that lunch, they stay in the church and become involved. Okay? It's a replacement for sort of the organic thing that would have happened back when we were smaller, when people just met somebody new. Okay. Then they get invited to come to the Vineyard 101 class. which is the new members class. This is the introduction to our church, where we're going, what it's about, you know, how you become involved, what our key values are, what the commitments are. We give them a free lunch for that thing, and it goes for 5 hours, 4 or 5 hours straight. We used to spread it out over several weeks, but we found that there were constant problems with people who came 1 week and not the other. So we finally said, enough of that. We're going to do it all in one day. We'll feed them. We'll give them breaks in the middle, but they're either there or they're not there. And so they go through that. From there, they can take part. Then we also offer regular classes that talk about other significant aspects of the values. So there's a whole thing on introducing them to the ministry of the Holy Spirit and praying. It's an all-day Saturday thing, like a little mini conference. And they go through the whole thing together. We offer that every year so that the new people can kind of catch up to what we're doing and so forth. And then there's similar things on other subjects. So there's a regular process of communication. There's also a thing where we help get them into small groups, where we introduce the idea of small groups. Here's what's available. We just recently had a small group sign-up Sunday. You know, so out in the lobby after the service, all the small group leaders are out there behind tables with things describing their groups and sign-up sheets, and all the newcomers could go out there and sign up, you know, ask questions and talk to them and sign up for a small group to be a part of, because we have a lot of newcomers we need to process. Okay, so those kinds of things you need to start putting in. What you need, essentially, are extra points of contact. Every additional point of contact with that person who's like finding their way into the church increases the likelihood that they're going to successfully, you know, become fully integrated in the church. Multiple contacts is what you need. You know, we also have a deal. We send them a letter after they visit, and they can stop at the Welcome Center and get a free worship CD, which becomes another point of contact. You just try to multiply how many contacts they have with people. We are out of time. Let's take our coffee break, and we'll hear from Terry.